I can't unlock my door.
So climb into the front seat, she said.
I can't, he said again.
He spoke like one sedated, and it came to Vic that he had to be drugged. Could a drug lower your body temperature enough to make your breath steam? She didn't think so.
I can't leave the back seat. You really shouldn't be here. He'll come back soon.
White, frozen air trickled from his nostrils. Vic heard him clearly enough, but didn't understand much of it, except for the last bit.
He'll come back soon.
Made perfect sense. Of course he was coming back. Whoever he was, the Wraith. He wouldn't have left the car running off the battery if he weren't going to be back soon, and she had to be gone by the time he returned. They both did. She wanted more than anything to take off, to bolt for the door, tell the kid she would come back with the police. But she could not go. If she ran, she would not just be leaving a sick and abducted child behind. She would be abandoning her own best self, too. She reached through the window and unlocked the front door and swung it open. Come on, she said. Take my hand. She reached over the back of the driver's seat, into the rear compartment. He looked into her palm for a moment, his gaze thoughtful, as if he were attempting to read her future, or as if she had offered him a chocolate and he was trying to decide whether he wanted it. That was the wrong way for a kidnapped child to react, and she knew it, but she still didn't pull her hand back in time. He gripped her wrist, and she screamed at his touch. His hand, blazing against her skin, was as bad as pressing her wrist to a hot frying pan. It took her an instant to register the sensation, not as heat, but as cold. The horn sounded with a great blast. In the confined space of the garage, the noise was almost too much to bear. Vic didn't know why it went off. She hadn't touched the steering wheel. "Let go! You're hurting me!" she said.
"I know," he said.
When he smiled, she saw that his mouth was full of little hooks, rows of them, each as small and delicate as a sewing needle. The rows of them seemed to go all the way down his throat. The horn sounded again. The boy raised his voice and shouted,
"Mr. Manx! Mr. Manx! I caught a girl! Mr. Manx, come see!"
Vic braced a foot against the driver's seat and threw herself backward, thrusting hard with her leg. The boy was yanked forward. She didn't think he was going to let go. His hand felt as if it were fused to her wrist, his skin frozen to hers. But when she drew her hand back across the rear divider, into the front seat, he released her. She fell back into the steering wheel, and the horn went off again. Her fault, this time. The boy hopped up and down on the rear seat in excitement.
"Mr. Manx! Mr. Manx! Come see the pretty girl!"
Vapor extruded from his nostrils and mouth. Vic dropped out of the open driver's side door and onto the concrete. Her shoulder hit a mess of stacked rakes and snow shovels, and they fell over on top of her with a crash. The horn went off again and again in a series of deafening blasts. Vic shoved the lawn tools off her. When she was on her knees, she looked at her wrist. It was hideous, a black burn in the rough shape of a child's hand. She slammed the driver's side door, took one last glance at the boy in the back seat. His face was eager, glistening with excitement. A black tongue lolled out of his mouth and rolled around his lips.
"Mr. Manx, she's running away!" he screamed.
His breath frosted over the window glass.
"Come see! Come see!"
She picked herself up and took one clumsy, off-balance step back toward the side door to the yard. The motor that ran the electric garage door roared to life, the chain overhead pulling it up with a grinding clatter. Vic caught herself, then began going back, fast as she could. The big garage door rose and rose, revealing black boots, silver-gray trousers, and she thought, "The Wraith. It's the Wraith." Vic lurched around the front of the car. Two steps led up to a door that she knew would open into the house itself. The knob turned. The door eased back onto darkness. Vic stepped through and pushed the door shut behind her and began to move across a mudroom. where dirt-scuffed linoleum was peeling up in one corner. Her legs had never felt so weak, and her ears were ringing from a scream that was stuck in her head, because she knew that if she screamed for real, the wraith would find her and kill her. About this, there was no doubt in her mind. He would kill her and bury her in the backyard, and no one would ever know what had become of her. She went through a second inner door and into a hallway that ran almost the entire length of the house and was carpeted in green wall-to-wall shag. The hall smelled like a turkey dinner. She ran, not bothering with the doors on either side of her, knowing they would only open into bathrooms and bedrooms. She clutched her right wrist, breathing through the pain. In 10 paces, the hall arrived at a little foyer. The door to the front yard was on the left, just beyond a narrow staircase climbing to the second floor. Hunting prints hung on the walls. Grinning, ruddy-faced men held up bunches of dead geese, displaying them to noble-looking golden retrievers. A pair of swinging batwing doors opened into a kitchen on Vic's right. The smell of turkey dinner was stronger here. It was warmer, too, feverishly warm. She saw her chance, saw it clear in her mind. The man called the Wraith was entering through the garage. He would follow her through the side door and into the house. If she bolted now, rushed across the front yard, she could reach the shorter way on foot. Vic lunged across the foyer, banging her hip on a side table. A lamp with a bead-trimmed shade wobbled, almost fell. She grabbed the doorknob, turned it, and was about to pull it open when she saw the view through the side window. He stood in the yard, one of the tallest men she had ever seen, 6.5 feet at least. He was bald, and there was something obscene about his pale skull, crawling with blue veins. He wore a coat from another era, a thing with tails and a double line of brass buttons down the front. He looked like a soldier, a colonel in the service of some foreign nation where an army was not called an army but a legion. He was turned slightly away from the house and toward the bridge, so she saw him in profile. He stood before the shorter way, one hand on the handlebars of her bike. Vic couldn't move. It was as if she had been injected with a paralytic. She could not even force her lungs to pull air. The Wraith cocked his head to one side, the body language of an inquisitive dog. In spite of his large skull, his features were weasel-like and crowded close together in the center of his face. He had a sunken chin and an overbite, which gave him a very dim, almost feeble look. He looked like the sort of rube who would say every syllable in the word homosexual. He considered her bridge, the vast length of it reaching back into the trees. Then he looked toward the house, and Vic pulled her face from the window, pressed her back flat against the door.
"Good afternoon, whoever you are," he cried. "Come on out and say how do. I will not bite."
Vic remembered to breathe. It was an effort, as if there were restricting bands strapped around her chest. The Wraith shouted,
"You dropped your bicycle in my yard. Wouldn't you like it back?" After a moment, he added, "You dropped your covered bridge in my yard as well. You can have that back, too."
He laughed. It was a pony's whinny.
"Hee!"
It crossed Vic's mind again that the man might be feeble. She shut her eyes and held herself rigidly against the door. Then it came to her. He hadn't said anything for a few moments, and that he might be approaching the front of the house. She turned the bolt, put the chain on. It took 3 tries to get the chain in place. Her hands were slippery with sweat, and she kept losing her grip on it. But no sooner had she locked the door than he spoke again, and she could tell by his voice that he was still standing out in the middle of the overgrown yard.
"I think I know about this bridge. Most people would be upset to find a covered bridge sitting in their front yard, but not Mr. Charles Talent Manx III. Mr. Charlie Manx is a man who knows a thing or two about bridges and roads turning up where they do not belong. I myself have driven some highways that don't belong. I have been driving for a long time. You would be surprised if you knew how long, I bet.
I know about one road I can only get to in my wraith. It isn't on any map, but it is there when I need it. It is there when I have a passenger who was ready to go to Christmas Land. Where does your bridge go? You should come out. We sure do have a lot in common. I bet we will be fast friends.
Vic decided then. Every moment she stood there listening to him was one less moment she had to save herself. She moved, pushed off from the door, raced down the foyer, batted through the batwing doors and into the kitchen. It was a small, dingy space with a yellow formica-top table in it and an ugly black phone on the wall under a sun-faded child's drawing. Dusty yellow polka-dot streamers dangled from the ceiling, hanging perfectly motionless in the still air, as if someone had thrown a birthday party here years ago and had never entirely cleaned up. To Vic's right was a metal door, open to reveal a pantry containing a washer and dryer, a few shelves of dry goods, and a stainless steel cabinet built into the wall. Beside the pantry door was a big Frigidaire with sloopy bathtub styling. The room was warm, the air close and stale. A TV dinner baked in the oven. She could envision the slices of turkey in one compartment, mashed potatoes in another, tin foil covering the dessert. Two bottles of orange pop stood on the counter. There was a door to the backyard. In three steps, Vic was there. The dead boy watched the rear of the house. She knew he was dead now, or worse than dead, that he was a child of the man Charlie Manx. He stood perfectly still in his rawhide coat and jeans and bare feet. His hood was pushed back to show his pale hair and the black branches of veins in his temples. His mouth was open to show his rows of needle teeth. He saw her and grinned, but did not move as she cried out and turned the bolt. He had left a trail of white footprints behind him, where the grass had frozen at the touch of his feet. His face had the glassy smoothness of enamel. His eyes were faintly clouded with frost.
"Come out," he said, his breath smoking. "Come on out here and stop being so silly. We will all go to Christmas Land together."
She backed away from the door. Her hip bumped the oven. She turned and began pulling open drawers, looking for a knife. The first one she opened was full of kitchen rags. The second held whisks, spatulas, dead flies. She went back to the first drawer, grabbed bunches of hand towels, opened the oven, and threw them in on top of the turkey dinner. She left the oven door parted a crack. There was a frying pan on the stove. She grabbed it by the handle. It felt good to have something to swing.
"Mr. Manx! Mr. Manx, I saw her! She's being a goof!" the boy shouted. Then he yelled, "This is fun!"
Vic turned and plunged through the batwing doors and back to the front of the house. She peered through the window by the door again. Manx had walked her bicycle closer to the bridge. He stood before the opening, considering the darkness, head cocked to one side, listening to it, perhaps. Finally, he seemed to decide something. He bent and gave the bicycle a strong, smooth shove out onto the bridge. Her Raleigh rolled across the threshold and into the darkness. An invisible needle slid into her left eye and back into her brain. She sobbed, couldn't help herself, and doubled over. The needle withdrew, then slid in again. She wanted her head to explode, wanted to die. She heard a pop, like her ears depressurizing, and the house shuddered. It was as if a jet had screamed by overhead, breaking the sound barrier. The front hall began to smell of smoke. Vic lifted her head and squinted out through the window. The shorter way was gone. She had known it would be, the moment she heard that hard, piercing pop. The bridge had collapsed into itself like a dying sun going nova. Charlie Manx walked toward the house, the tails of his coat flapping. There was no humor in his pinched, ugly face now. He looked instead like a stupid man, set upon doing something barbaric. She glanced at the stairs, but knew if she went up there, she would have no way back down. That left the kitchen. When she stepped through the batwing doors, the boy was at the rear door, his face up against the glass of the window set into it. He grinned to show his mouthful of delicate hooks, those fine rows of curving bones. His breath spread feathers of silvery frost across the pane. The phone rang. Vic yelped as if someone had grabbed her, looked around at it. Her face batted against the yellow polka dot streamers hanging from the ceiling. Only they weren't streamers at all. They were strips of flypaper, with dozens of withered, dead fly husks stuck to them. There was bile in the back of Vic's throat. It tasted sour sweet, like a frappe from Terry's gone bad. The phone rang again. She grabbed the receiver, but before she picked it up, her gaze fixed on the child's drawing taped directly above the phone. The paper was dry and brown and brittle with age, the tape gone yellow. It showed a forest of crayon Christmas trees, and the man called Charlie Manx in a Santa hat, with two little girls grinning to show a mouthful of fangs. The children in the picture were very like the thing in the backyard that had once been a child. Vic put the phone to her ear. "Help me," she cried. "Help me, please."
"Where are you, ma'am?"
said someone with a childlike voice.
"I don't know. I don't know. I'm lost."
"We already have a car there. It's in the garage. Go get in the back seat, and our driver will take you to Christmasland."
Whoever was on the other end of the line giggled.
"We'll take care of you when you get here. We'll hang your eyeballs from our big Christmas tree."
Vic hung up. She heard a crunch behind her, whirled, and saw that the little boy had slammed his forehead into the window. A spider web of shattered glass filled the pane. The boy himself seemed uninjured. Back in the foyer, she heard Manx force the front door open, heard it catch against the chain. The child pulled his head back, then snapped it forward, and his forehead hit the window with another hard crunch. Splinters of glass fell. The boy laughed. The first yellow flames licked out of the half-open oven. They made a sound like a pigeon beating its wings. The wallpaper to the right of the oven was blackening, curling. Vic no longer remembered why she had wanted to start a fire, something about escaping in a confusion of smoke. The child reached through the shattered windowpane, his hand feeling for the bolt. Jagged glass points scraped his wrist, peeled up shavings of skin, drew black blood. It didn't seem to bother him. Vic swung the frying pan at his hand. She threw herself into her swing with her whole weight, and the force of the blow carried her straight into the door. She recoiled, stumbled backward, and sat down on the floor. The boy jerked his hand outside, and she saw that three of his fingers had been smashed out of true, grotesquely bent the wrong way.
"You're funny,"
he shouted and laughed. Vic kicked her heels, sliding backward on her ass across the cream-colored tiles. The boy stuck his face through the broken windowpane and waggled his black tongue at her. Red flame belched out of the oven, and for a moment her hair was burning on the right side of her head, the fine hairs crinkling and charring and shriveling up. She swatted at herself. Sparks flew. Manx hit the front door. The chain snapped with a tinny clinking sound. The bolt tore free with a loud crack. She heard the door smash into the wall with a house-shaking bang. The boy reached through the broken window again and unlocked the back door. Burning strips of flypaper fell around her. Vic shoved herself up off her ass and turned, and Manx was on the other side of the batwing doors, about to step into the kitchen. He looked at her with a wide-eyed and avid fascination on his ugly face.
"When I saw your bike, I thought you would be younger," Manx said, "but you are all grown. That is too bad for you. Christmasland is not such a good place for girls who are all grown."
The door behind her opened, and when it did, there was a feeling of all the hot air being sucked out of the room, as if the world outside were inhaling. A red cyclone of flame whirled from the open oven, and a thousand hot sparks whirled with it. Black smoke gushed. When Manx swatted through the batwing doors, coming for her, Vic shied away from him, squirming out of reach and ducking behind the big, bulky Frigidaire, stepping toward the only place that remained to her, into the pantry. She grabbed the metal handle of the door and slammed it shut behind her. It was a heavy door, and it squalled as she dragged it across the floor. She had never moved such a heavy door in all her life. It had no lock of any kind. The handle was an iron U, bolted to the metal surface. Vic grabbed it and set her heels apart, her feet planted on the door frame. A moment later, Manx yanked. She buckled, was jerked forward, but locked her knees and held it shut. He eased off, then suddenly pulled again, a second time, trying to catch her napping. He had at least 70 pounds on her, and those gangly orangutan arms of his, but with her feet braced against the doorframe, her arms would come out of their sockets before her legs gave. Manx stopped pulling. Vic had an instant to look around and saw a mop with a long blue metal handle. It was just to her right, within arm's reach. She pushed it through the U-shaped door latch, so the mop handle was braced across the doorframe. Vic let go and stepped back, and her legs wobbled, and she almost sat down. She had to lean against the washing machine to keep her feet. Manx pulled the door again, and the mop handle bashed against the frame. He paused. When he pulled at the door the next time, he did so gently, in an almost experimental way. Vic heard him cough. She thought she heard childlike whispering. Her legs shook. They shook so forcefully that she knew if she let go of the washing machine, she'd fall over.
"You've got yourself in a tight spot now, you little firebug," Manx called through the door.
"Go away!" she screamed.
"It takes a lot of brass to break into a man's house and then tell him to get," he said, but he said it with good humor. "You are scared to come out, I suppose. If you had any sense, you would be more scared to stay where you are."
"Go away!" she screamed again. It was all she could think to say.
He coughed once more. A frantic red firelight glimmered at the bottom of the door, broken by two shadows that marked where Charlie Manx had placed his feet. There was another moment of whispering.
"Child," he said to her, "I will let this house burn without a second thought. I have other places to go, and this hidey hole has been burned for me now, one way or another. Come out. Come out, or you will smother to death in there, and no one will ever identify your burnt remains. Open the door. I will not hurt you."
She leaned back against the washing machine, gripping the edge with both hands, her legs wobbling furiously, almost comically.
"Pity," he said. "I would have liked to know a girl who had a vehicle of her own, one that can travel the roads of thought. Our kind is rare. We should learn from one another. Well, you will learn from me now, although I think you will not much care for the lesson. I would stay and talk longer, but it is getting a trifle warm in here. I am a man who prefers cooler climes, to be honest. I am so fond of winter, I am practically one of Santa's elves."
And he laughed again, that whinnying shit-kicker laugh.
"Hee-hee-hee-hee-hee!"
Something turned over in the kitchen. It fell with such an enormous crash that she screamed and almost leaped onto the washing machine. The impact shook the whole house and sent a hideous vibration through the tiles beneath her. For a moment she thought the floor might be in danger of caving in. She knew from the sound, from the weight, from the force of it, what he had done. He had gripped that big old fridge with the sloopy bathtub styling and overturned it in front of the door. Vic stood a long time against the washing machine, waiting for her legs to stop shaking. She did not, at first, really believe that Manx was gone. She felt he was waiting for her to throw herself against the door, hammering against it and pleading to be let out. She could hear the fire. She heard things popping and cracking in the heat. The wallpaper sizzled with a crispy fizzling sound, like someone pitching handfuls of pine needles into a campfire. Vic put her ear to the door, to better hear the other room. But at the first touch of skin to metal, she jerked her head back with a cry. The iron door was as hot as a skillet left on high heat. A dirty brown smoke began to trickle in along the left-hand edge of the door. Vic yanked the steel mop handle free, chucked it aside. She grabbed the handle, meant to give it a shove, see how far she could push it against the weight on the other side. But then she let go, jumped back. The curved metal handle was as hot as the surface of the door. Vic shook her hand in the air to soothe the burned feeling in her fingertips. She caught her first mouthful of smoke. It stank of melted plastic. It was so filthy smelling she choked on it, bent over coughing so hard she thought she might vomit. She turned in a circle. There was hardly space in the pantry to do more than that. Shelves, rice-a-roni, a bucket, a bottle of ammonia, a bottle of bleach, a stainless steel cabinet or drawer set into the wall, the washing machine and the dryer. There were no windows. There was no other door. Something glass exploded in the next room. Vic was aware of a gathering filminess in the air, as if she stood in a sauna. She glanced up and saw that the white plaster ceiling was blackening directly above the doorframe. She opened the dryer and found an old white fitted sheet. She tugged it out. Vic pulled it over her head and shoulders, wrapped some fabric around one hand, and tried the door. She could only barely grip the metal handle, even with the sheet, and could not press her shoulder to the door for long. But Vic flung herself hard against it once and again. It shuddered and banged in the frame and opened maybe a quarter of an inch, enough to let in a gush of vile brown smoke. There was too much smoke on the other side of the door to allow her to see anything of the room, to even see flames. Vic drew back and pitched herself at the door a third time. She hit so hard she bounced, and her ankles caught in the bedsheet, and she fell sprawling. She shouted in frustration, threw off the sheet. The pantry was dirty with smoke. She reached up, gripped the washing machine with one hand, and the handle of the stainless steel cabinet with the other. But as she pulled herself to her feet, the door to the cabinet fell open, hinges whining, and she crashed back down, her knees giving out. She rested before trying again, turned her face so her brow was pressed to the cool metal of the washing machine. When she shut her eyes, she felt her mother pressing one cool hand to her fevered forehead. Vic reclaimed her feet, unsteady now. She let go of the handle of the metal cabinet, and it clapped shut on a spring. The poisonous air stung her eyes. She opened the cabinet again. It looked into a laundry chute, a dark, narrow metal shaft. Vic put her head through the opening and looked up. She saw, dimly, another small door, 10 or 12 feet up. "He's waiting up there," she knew. But it didn't matter. Remaining in the pantry wasn't an option. She sat on the open steel door, which swung down from the wall on a pair of taut springs. Vic squirmed her upper body through the opening, pulled her legs after her, and slid into the laundry chute. Vic was, at 17, only 40 pounds heavier and 3 inches taller than she had been at 12, a skinny girl who was all leg. But it was tight inside the chute just the same. She braced herself, back to the wall, knees in her face, feet pressing to the opposite side of the shaft. Vic began to work her way up the shaft, pushing herself with the balls of her feet, 6 inches at a time. Brown smoke wafted around her and stung her eyes. Her hamstrings began to twitch and burn. She slid her back up another 6 inches, walking up the shaft in a hunched, bent, grotesque sort of way. The muscles in the small of her back throbbed. She was halfway to the second floor when her left foot slipped, squirting out beneath her, and her ass dropped. She felt a tearing in her right thigh, and she screamed. For one moment she was able to hold herself in place, folded over with her right knee in her face and her left leg hanging straight down. But the weight on her right leg was too much, the pain was too much. She let her right foot slide free and fell all the way back to the bottom. It was a painful, ungraceful fall. She clouted into the aluminum floor of the shaft, spiked her right knee into her own face. Her other foot banged through the stainless steel hatch and shot back into the pantry. Vic was, for a moment, dangerously close to panic. She began to cry, and when she stood up in the laundry chute, she did not try to climb again but began to jump. And never mind that the top was well out of reach and there was nothing in the smooth aluminum shaft to grab. She screamed. She screamed for help. The shaft was full of smoke, and it blurred her vision, and mid-scream she began to cough, a harsh, dry, painful cough. She coughed on and on, did not think she would ever stop. She coughed with such force she almost threw up, and in the end spit a long stream of saliva that tasted of bile. It was not the smoke that terrified her, or the pain in the back of her right thigh, where she had definitely yanked a muscle. It was her certain, desperate aloneness. What had her mother screamed at her father?
But you're not raising her, Chris! I am! I'm doing it all by myself!
It was awful to find yourself in a hole, all by yourself. She could not remember the last time she had held her mother. Her frightened, short-tempered, unhappy mother, who had stood by her and put her cool hand to Vic's brow in her times of fever. It was awful to think of dying here, having left things as they were.
Then she was making her way up the shaft again, back to one wall, feet to the other. Her eyes gushed. The smoke was thick in the chute now, a brownish, billowing stream all around her.
Something was terribly wrong in the back of her right leg. Every time she pushed upward with her feet, it felt as if the muscle were tearing all over again. She blinked and coughed and pushed and wormed her way steadily up the laundry chute. The metal against her back was uncomfortably warm. She thought that in a very short time, she would be leaving skin on the walls, that the chute would burn to the touch. Except it wasn't a chute anymore. It was a chimney, with a smoky fire at the bottom, and she was Santa Claus, scrambling up for the reindeer. She had that idiot Christmas song in her head, "Have a holly, jolly, fucking Christmas," going around and around on endless loop. She didn't want to roast to death with Christmas music in her head. By the time she was close to the top of the chute, it was hard to see anything through all the smoke. She wept continuously and held her breath. The big muscle in her right thigh shook helplessly. She saw an inverted U of dim light somewhere just above her feet. The hatch that opened on the second floor. Her lungs burned. She gasped, couldn't stop herself, drew a chestful of smoke, began to cough. It hurt to cough. She could feel soft tissues behind her ribs rupturing and tearing. Her right leg gave without warning. She lunged as she fell, shoving her arms at the closed hatch. As she did, she thought, "It won't open." He pushed something in front of it, and it won't open. Her arms banged through the hatch, out into beautifully cool air. She held on, caught the edge of the opening under her armpits. Her legs dropped down into the chute, and her knees clubbed the steel wall. With the hatch open, the laundry chute drew air, and she felt a hot, stinking breeze lifting around her. Smoke gushed out around her head. She couldn't stop coughing and blinking, coughing so hard her whole body shook. She tasted blood, felt blood on her lips, wondered if she was coughing up anything important. For a long moment, she hung where she was, too weak to pull herself out. Then she began to kick, digging her toes against the wall. Her feet clanged and banged. She could not grab much purchase, but she did not need much. Her head and arms were already through the hatch, and getting out of the chute was less a matter of climbing, more a thing of simply leaning forward. She tipped herself out and onto the shag carpet of a second-floor hallway. The air tasted good. She lay there and gasped like a fish.
What a blessed if painful thing, this business of being alive.
She had to lean against the wall to get her feet. She expected the entire house to be filled with smoke and roaring fire, but it was not. It was hazy in the upstairs hallway, but not as bad as it had been in the chute. Vic saw sunshine to her right and limped across the bushy 1970s-era carpet to the landing at the top of the stairs. She descended the stairs in a stumbling, controlled fall, splashing through smoke. The front door was half open. The chain hung from the doorframe, with the lock plate and a long splinter of wood dangling from it. The air that came in was watery cool, and she wanted to pitch herself out into it, but she did not. She could not see into the kitchen. It was all smoke and flickering light. An open doorway looked into a sitting room. The wallpaper on the far side of the sitting room was burning away to show the plaster underneath. The rug smoldered. A vase contained a bouquet of flame. Streams of orange fire crawled up cheap white nylon curtains. She thought the whole back of the house might be in flame, but here in the front, in the foyer, the hallway was only filled with smoke. Vic looked out the window to one side of the door. The drive leading up to the house was a long, narrow dirt lane, leading away through the trees. She saw no car, but from this angle she could not see into the garage. He might be sitting there waiting to see if Vic would come out. He might be down at the end of the lane, watching to see if she would run up it. Behind her, something creaked painfully and fell with a great crash. Smoke erupted around her. A hot spark touched her arm and stung, and it came to her that there was nothing left to think about. He was waiting there, or he wasn't. But either way, there was no place left for her to go except out. The yard was so overgrown it was like running through a tangle of wire. The grass made snares to catch her ankles. There was really no yard to speak of, only an expanse of wild brush and weeds and forest beyond. She did not so much as glance at the garage or back at the house, and she did not run for the driveway. She didn't dare test that long, straight road for fear he might be parked along it, spying for her. Instead, she ran for the trees. She did not see that there was an embankment until she was going over it, a 3-foot drop to the forest floor. She hit hard on her toes, felt the back of her right thigh grab with a painful force. She crashed into a drift of dry branches, struggled free of them, and dropped onto her back. The pines towered above her. They swayed in the wind. The ornaments that hung in them twinkled and blinked and made flashing rainbows, so it was as if she had been lightly concussed. When she had her breath back, she rolled over, got on her knees, looked across the yard. The big garage door was open, but the Rolls-Royce was gone. She was surprised, almost disappointed, at how little smoke there was. She could see a steady gray film rising from the rear of the house. Smoke spilled from the open mouth of the front door. But she could not hear anything burning from here, and could not see any flame. She had expected the house to be a bonfire. Then Vic was up and moving again. She could not run, but she could hurry in a limping jog. Her lungs felt baked, and every other step there was a fresh ripping sensation in the back of her right thigh. She was less aware of her innumerable other hurts and aches, the cold burn on her right wrist, the steady stabbing pain in her left eyeball. She stayed parallel to the drive, keeping it 50 feet off on her left, ready to duck behind brush or a tree trunk if she saw the Rolls. But the dirt lane led straight and true away from the little white house, with no sign of the old car, or the man Charles Manx, or the dead boy who traveled with him. She followed the narrow dirt road for an uncertain period. She had lost her usual sense of time passing, did not have any idea, then or later, how long she made her way through the woods. Each moment was the longest single moment of her life, until the next. It seemed to her later that her staggering escape through the trees was as long as all the rest of her childhood. By the time she saw the highway, she had left her childhood well behind her. It smoldered and burnt to nothing, along with the rest of the sleigh house. The embankment leading up to the highway was higher than the one she had fallen down, and she had to climb on her hands and knees, grabbing clumps of grass to hoist herself up. As she reached the top of the slope, she heard a rat-a-tat buzzing sound, the whine and blast of an approaching motorcycle. It was coming from her right, but by the time she found her feet, it was already past, big guy in black on a Harley. The highway ran on a straight line through forest beneath a confusion of stormy clouds. To her left were lots of high blue hills, and for the first time Vic had a sense of being somewhere high up herself. In Haverhill, Massachusetts, she rarely gave a second thought to altitude, but now she understood that it wasn't the clouds that were low, but herself that was high. She reeled out onto the blacktop, chasing the Harley, shouting and waving her arms. "He won't hear," she thought. There was no way, not over the rowdy tear of his own engine. But the big man looked back over his shoulder, and the front wheel of his Harley wobbled before he straightened out and swerved to the side of the highway. He didn't have a helmet on, and was a fat man with beard on both of his chins, his brown hair curled at the nape of his neck in a luxuriant mullet. Vic ran toward him, the pain stabbing her in the back of the right leg with each step. When she reached the motorcycle, she did not hesitate or explain herself, but threw one leg over the seat, getting her arms around his waist. His eyes were amazed and a little frightened. He had black leather gloves with the fingers snipped off and a black leather jacket. but the coat was unzipped to show a Weird Al t-shirt. And from this close, she could see he was not the grown-up she had first taken him for. His skin was smooth and pink beneath the beard, and his emotions were almost childishly plain. He might have been no older than her.
"Dude," he said, "are you all right? You been in an accident?"
"I need the police. There's a man. He wanted to kill me. He trapped me in a room and set fire to his house. He's got a little boy. There was a little boy, and I almost didn't get out, and he took the boy with him. We need to go. He might come back." She was not sure any of this made sense. It was the right information, but it seemed to her she had arranged it poorly. The bearded fat man goggled at her, as if she were speaking to him frantically in a foreign tongue. Tagalog, perhaps, or Klingon. Although, as it turned out, if she had addressed him in Klingon, Lewis Carmody probably would have been able to translate.
"Fire!" she shouted. "Fire!"
She stabbed a finger back in the direction of the dirt lane. She could not see the house from the highway, and the faint wisp of smoke that rose over the trees might have been from someone's chimney or a pile of burning leaves. But it was enough to break him out of his trance and get him moving.
"Hold the fuck on!" he cried, his voice cracking, going high-pitched, and he gave his bike so much throttle that Vic thought he was going to pop a wheelie.
Her stomach plunged, and she squeezed her arms around his gut so the tips of her fingers could almost but not quite touch. She thought he was going to dump it. The bike weaved dangerously, the front end going one way, the back end going the other. But he straightened it out, and the center white line began to flick by in machine gun staccato. So did the pines to either side of the road. Vic dared one look back. She expected to see the old black car lurching up out of the dirt road, but the highway was empty. She turned her head and pressed it into the fat kid's back, and they left the old man's house behind, riding toward the blue hills, and they were away, and they were safe, and it was over. Above Gun Barrel, Colorado. Then he began to slow down.
"What are you doing?" she cried.
They had traveled less than half a mile down the highway. She looked back over her shoulder. She could still see the dirt road leading up to that awful house.
"Dude," the kid said, "we, like, need to get us some help. They'll have a phone right in here."
They were approaching a pitted and cracked blacktop lane, leading off to the right, and at the corner of the intersection was a country store with a couple pumps out front. The kid ran the bike right up to the porch. It died all of a sudden, the instant he flipped the kickstand down. He had not bothered to put it in neutral. She wanted to tell him no, not here. This was too close to the guy's house. But the fat boy was already off and giving her his hand to help her down. She stumbled on the first step going up to the porch and almost fell. He caught her in his arms. She turned and looked at him, blinking at tears. Why was she crying? She didn't know, only knew that she was, helplessly, sipping at the air in short, choked breaths. Curiously, the fat boy, Lewis Carmody, just 20, a kid with a record of stupid crimes, vandalism, shoplifting, smoking underage, looked like he might start crying himself. She didn't learn his name until later.
"Hey," he said. "Hey, I won't let anything bad happen to you. You're all right now. I got your back."
She wanted to believe him. Already, though, she understood the difference between being a child and being an adult. The difference is that when someone says he can keep the bad things away, a child believes him. She wanted to believe him, but she couldn't. So she decided to kiss him instead. Not now, but later. Later she would kiss him the best kiss ever. He was chubby and had bad hair, and she suspected he had never been kissed by a pretty girl before. Vic was never going to be modeling in an underwear catalog, but she was pretty enough. She knew he thought so, too, from the reluctant way he let go of her waist.
"Let's go in there and bring a whole mess of law down here," he said. "How about that?"
"And fire trucks," she said.
"That too," he said.
Lou walked her into a pine-floored country grocery. Pickled eggs floated like cow eyeballs in a jar of yellowing fluid on the counter. A small line of customers led to the lone cash register. The man behind the counter had a corncob pipe in the corner of his mouth. With his pipe, squinty eyes, and bulging chin, he bore more than a passing resemblance to Popeye the Sailor Man. A young man in military fatigue stood at the head of the line, holding a few bills in his hand. His wife waited beside him, baby in arms.
His wife was, at most, only 5 years older than Vic herself, her blonde hair held back in a ponytail by an elastic loop. The tow-headed infant in her arms wore a Batman onesie with tomato sauce stains down the front, evidence of a nutritious lunch by way of Chef Boyardee.
"Excuse me," Lou said, raising his thin, piping voice. No one so much as looked around. "Didn't you have a milk car once, Sam?" said the young man in fatigues. "It's true," said the guy who looked like Popeye, punching some keys on the register. "But you don't want to hear about my ex-wife again."
The old boys gathered around the counter erupted into laughter. The blonde with the baby smiled indulgently and looked around, and her gaze settled on Lou and Vic, her brow furrowed with concern.
"Everyone listen to me!" Lou screamed,
and this time they all heard and turned to stare.
"We need to use your phone!"
"Hey, honey," said the blonde with the infant, speaking directly to Vic. The way she said it, Vic knew she was a waitress and called everyone honey or hun or darling or doll.
"You okay? What happened? You have an accident?" "She's lucky to be alive," Lou said. "There's a man down the road had her locked up in his house. He tried to burn her to death. The house is still on fire. She only just got out of there. The fucker still has some little kid with him."
Vic shook her head. No, no, that was not exactly right. The little kid was not being held against his will. The little kid wasn't even a little kid anymore. He was something else. Something so cold it hurt to touch him. But she couldn't figure out how to correct Lou, and so she said nothing. The blonde looked at Lou Carmody while he was speaking, then back, and when her gaze returned to Vic, it was subtly altered. It was a look of calm, intense appraisal, a look Vic knew well from her own mother's face. It was the way Linda sized up an injury, judging it on a scale of severity, settling on the appropriate treatment.
"What's your name, darling?"
the blonde asked. "Victoria," Vic said, something she never did, refer to herself by her whole first name.
"You're okay now, Victoria," said the blonde,
and her voice was so kind that Vic began to sob. The blonde took quiet command of the room and everyone in it then, all without raising her voice or ever setting down her toddler. Later, when Vic thought about what she liked best in women, she always thought of the soldier's wife, of her certainty and her quiet decency. She thought of mothering, which was really another word for being present and caring what happened to someone. She wished for that certainty herself, that grounded awareness that she saw in the soldier's wife, and thought she would like to be a woman such as this, a mother with the steady, sure, feminine awareness of what to do in a crisis. In some ways, Vic's own son, Bruce, was really conceived in that moment, although she would not be pregnant with him for another 3 years. Vic sat on some boxes to one side of the counter. The man who reminded her of Popeye was already on the phone, asking for an operator to give him the police. His voice was calm. No one was overreacting, because the blonde didn't overreact, the others taking their emotional cues from her.
"Are you from around here?"
the soldier's wife asked.
"I'm from Haverhill."
"Is that in Colorado?" asked the soldier, whose name was Tom Priest.
He was on 2 weeks' leave and was due to head back to Saudi Arabia by way of Fort Hood that evening. Vic shook her head.
"Massachusetts. I need to call my mom. She hasn't seen me in days."
From that moment on, Vic was never able to work her way back to anything like the truth. She had been missing from Massachusetts for 2 days. Now she was in Colorado and had escaped a man who had her locked up in his house, who tried to burn her to death. Without ever saying she had been kidnapped, it became clear to everyone that this was the case. That became the new truth, even for Vic herself. In the same way she was able to persuade herself she had found her mother's bracelet in the family station wagon, and not at Terry's Primo Subs in Hampton Beach. The lies were easy to tell, because they never felt like lies at all. When she was asked about her trip to Colorado, she said she had no memory of being in Charlie Manx's car, and police officers traded sad, sympathetic looks. When they pressed her, she said it was all dark. Dark like she had been locked in the trunk? Yes, maybe. Someone else wrote her statement. She signed it without ever bothering to read it. The soldier said, "Where'd you get away from him?" "Right down the road," Lewis Carmody said, answering for Vic, who could not find her voice. "Half a mile away. I could lead you back there. It's out in the woods.
Dude, they don't get the fire trucks there pretty quick. Half the hill will be on fire.
That's a Father Christmas place, said Popeye, moving his mouth away from the phone.
Father Christmas? The soldier said.
A gourd-shaped man in a red and white checked shirt said, I know it. I've been by there hunting. It's weird. The trees outside are decorated for Christmas all year round. I've never seen anyone there, though.
This guy set fire to his own house and drove off? The soldier asked.
And he's still got a kid with him, Lou said.
What kind of car is he in?
Vic opened her mouth to reply, and then she saw movement outside, through the window in the door, and looked past the soldier. And it was the Wraith, pulling up to the pumps, arriving as if summoned by this very question. Even from a distance through a closed door, she could hear Christmas music.
Sam's Gas and Sundries.
Vic couldn't cry out, couldn't speak, but she didn't need to. The soldier saw her face and where she was looking, and turned his head to see what had stopped at the pumps. The driver climbed from the front seat and walked around the car to gas up.
That guy? The soldier asked. The limo driver?
Vic nodded.
I don't see a kid with him,
Lou said, craning his neck to look out the front picture window. This was met by a moment of sickened silence, everyone in the store taking stock of what it might mean.
Does he have a gun? The soldier said.
I don't know, Vic said. I didn't see one.
The soldier turned and started toward the door. His wife gave him a sharp look.
What do you think you're doing?
The soldier said. What do you think?
You let the police handle it, Tom Priest.
I will, when they get here. But he's not driving away before they do.
I'll come with you, Tommy, said the hefty man in the red and white checked shirt. I ought to be with you anyway. I'm the only man in this room got a badge in his pocket.
Popeye lowered the mouthpiece of the phone, covered it with one hand, and said,
Alan, your badge says Game Warden, and it looks like it came out of a Cracker Jack box.
It did not come out of a Cracker Jack box, said Alan Warner,
adjusting an invisible tie and raising his bushy silver eyebrows in an expression of mock rage.
I had to send away to a very respectable establishment for it. Got myself a squirt gun and a real pirate eye patch from the same place.
If you insist on going out there, said Popeye, reaching under the counter, take this with you.
And he set a big black .45 automatic next to the register, pushed it with one hand toward the game warden. Alan Warner frowned at it and gave his head a little shake.
I better not. I don't know how many deer I've put down, but I wouldn't like to point a gun at no man. Tommy?
The soldier named Tom Priest hesitated, then crossed the floor and hefted the .45. He turned it to check the safety.
Thomas, said the soldier's wife. She jiggled their baby in her arms. You have an 18-month-old child here. What are you going to do if that man pulls a pistol of his own?
Shoot him, Tom said.
God damn it, she said in a voice just louder than a whisper. God damn it!
He smiled, and when he did, he looked like a 10-year-old boy about to blow out his birthday candles.
Katie, I have to go do this. I'm on active duty with the U.S. Army, and I'm authorized to enforce federal law. We just heard that this guy transported a minor across state lines against her will. That's kidnapping. I am obligated to put his ass on the ground and hold him for the civilian authorities. Now that's enough talk about it.
Why don't we just wait for him to walk on in here and pay for his gas? Asked Popeye.
But Tom and the game warden, Alan, were moving together toward the door. Alan glanced back.
We don't know we won't just drive away without paying. Stop your fretting. This is going to be fun. I haven't had to tackle nobody since senior year.
Lou Carmody swallowed thickly and said,
I'll back your play,
and started after the two men. The pretty blonde, Katie, caught his arm before he could make three steps. She probably saved Louis Carmody's life. You've done enough. I want you to stay right here. You might have to get on the phone in a minute and tell your side of the story to the police, she told him, in a voice that brooked no argument. Lou sighed in a shaky sort of way, and his shoulders went slack. He looked relieved, looked like he wanted to lie down. Vic thought she understood. Heroism was exhausting business.
Ladies, Alan Warner said, nodding to Katie and Vic as he went by.
Tom Priest led the other man out the door and pulled it shut behind them, the little brass bell tinkling.
Vic watched the whole thing from the front windows. They all did. She saw Priest and Warner cross the asphalt, the soldier in the lead carrying the .45 down by his right leg. The Rolls was on the far side of the pumps, and the driver had his back to the two men. He didn't look around as they approached, continued filling the tank. Tom Priest didn't wait or attempt to explain himself. He put his hand in the center of Manx's back and shoved him into the side of the car. He planted the barrel of the .45 against his back. Alan stood a safe distance away, behind Tom, between the two pumps, letting the soldier do the talking. Charlie Manx tried to straighten up, but Priest shoved him into the car again, slamming him into the Wraith. The Rolls, built in Bristol in 1938 by a company that would soon be engineering tanks for the Royal Marines, did not so much as rock on its springs. Tom Priest's sunburned face was a rigid, unfriendly mask. There was no hint of the child's smile now. He looked like a vicious son of a bitch in jack boots and dog tags. He gave an order in a low voice, and slowly, slowly, Manx lifted his hands and set them on the roof of the Rolls-Royce. Tom dipped his free left hand into the pocket of Manx's black coat and removed some coins, a brass lighter, and a silver wallet. He set them on the roof of the car. At that point, there was a bang, or a thump, at the back end of the Rolls. It was forceful enough to shake the whole vehicle on its frame. Tom Priest glanced at Alan Warner. "Alan," Tom said. His voice was loud enough now that they could hear him inside. "Go around and get the keys out of the ignition. Let's see what's in the trunk." Alan nodded and started around the front of the car, pulling his hanky out to squeeze his nose. He made it to the driver's side door, where the window was open about 8 inches, and reached in for the keys. And that was when things began to go wrong. The window went up. No one was sitting in the car. There was no one to turn the crank. But the glass rose smoothly, all at once, slicing into Alan Warner's arm, trapping it in place. Alan screamed, throwing his head back and shutting his eyes, rising up on his toes in pain. Tom Priest glanced away from Charlie Manx for a moment, only one, and the passenger door flew open. It caught the soldier in the right side, knocked him into the pump, and turned him halfway around. The gun clattered across the blacktop. The car door seemed to have opened itself. From where Vic stood, it appeared no one had laid a hand on it. She thought automatically of Knight Rider, a show she had not watched in 10 years, and the way Michael Knight's slick Trans Am could drive itself, think for itself, eject people it didn't like, open its doors for people it did. Manx dropped his left hand and came up holding the gas hose. He cracked the metal nozzle into Tom's head, banging him across the bridge of the nose and squeezing the trigger at the same time, so gasoline gushed into the soldier's face, down the front of his fatigues. Tom Priest issued a strangled cry and put his hands over his eyes. Manx hit him again, slamming the nozzle of the hose into the center of his head, as if trying to trepan him with it. Bright, clear gasoline flew, bubbled over Priest's head. Alan screamed and screamed again. The car began to creep forward, dragging him by the arm. Priest tried to throw himself at Manx, but the tall man was already stepping back and out of the way, and Tom fell to all fours on the blacktop. Manx poured gasoline all down his back, soaking him as a man might water his lawn with a garden hose. The objects on top of the car, the coins, the lighter, slid off as the car continued to roll gently forward. Manx reached and caught the bright brass lighter as effortlessly as a first baseman reaching for a lazy infield fly. Someone shoved Vic from the left, Lou Carmody, and she staggered into the blonde named Katie. Katie was screaming her husband's name, bent over almost double from the force of her own yells. The toddler in her arms was yelling too. "Waddy! Waddy!" The door flew open. Men spilled onto the porch. Vic's view was momentarily obscured by people rushing past her. When she could see the blacktop again, Manx had stepped back and flicked his lighter. He dropped it onto the soldier's back, and Tom Priest ignited in a great blast of blue fire, which threw a burst of heat with enough force to rattle the windows of the store. The Wraith was rolling steadily now, dragging the game warden named Alan Warner helplessly along with it. The fat man bellowed, punching his free hand against the door as if he could pound it into letting him go. Some gasoline had splashed up the side of the car. The rear passenger side tire was a churning hoop of flame. Charlie Manx took another step back from the burning, writhing soldier and was hit from behind by one of the other customers, a skinny old man in suspenders. The two of them went down together. Lou Carmody leapt over them both, pulling off his jacket to throw it on Tom Priest's